Hey, it's Francis Lamb. You know, we end the show every week with credits for our producers, but now I want to start by thanking you. That's because we're a listener-supported show, so we literally can't make it without you. If you like what you hear, please head to splendidtable.org and click that donate button. All right, that's enough tasteful begging. Let's get to the show.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Sally Swift, in this week for Francis Lamb. We've put together a show this week that we hope will both drive you into the kitchen to cook and also make you think about some of the details around that cooking. Now, one of the things you may not know about our new host, Francis Lamb, is that he has both cooked in restaurants and graduated from the CIA. Now, that's the Culinary Institute of America, not that other one. And all that makes him particularly good at restaurant shop talk. A couple years ago, Francis talked to Jimmy Yui. Jimmy was born into a restaurant family and has always felt that chefs were true artists. He studied architecture and then decided to use his design skills to help chefs realize their artistry. Now, 30 years later, he's designed kitchens for some of the world's culinary greats, including Jose Andres, Eric Rappaire, and Masaharu Morimoto. But he prides himself on the fact that you may never know he designed them because he insists that every single kitchen he does reflects the personality of the chef rather than the designer. Francis talked to Jimmy about how he gets chefs to dream up their ideal kitchens.
So Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love the show.
You know, I think so much of design is really about listening, right? One of the hardest things I think that I've heard designers say to me is how you know what a client really wants. And a lot of it is really about getting to know your client and getting into their head and imagining you're them so you can start to intuit what it is that they need and what it is they want. And in your work, when you're working with chefs, how do you do that? What's the first thing you do when you start talking to a chef about their dream kitchen?
Well, that's actually spot on. I think any decent designer will tell you that what we really do is listen really, really hard. And intuit is a good word. We really have to get into their head and understand the nuances of what they're actually trying to articulate to you. With chefs, lucky for me, we always start out with chefs saying, you have to come to the restaurant, sit down, eat my food, and then next, hang around the kitchen, watch service for as long and as many services as you can muster. And it's very, very important because, one, in eating their food, they're actually trying to show you what their soul is about, what their product is about, what their art is about. It's really, really important. And then the second part of it is the execution. And watching the cooks in a kitchen, I like to think of it as very much a dance that occurs with a chef being a conductor in front of an orchestra. And watching the movement is really, really important because you need to understand what kind of motion is necessary to produce the art that they're trying to produce.
Hmm. Is it helpful if the kitchen designer actually knows how to cook him or herself?
I think it's paramount. I'm not entirely sure how, if you didn't know how to cook at all, if you weren't interested in food, if you weren't excited about learning about what the chef is doing, I can't imagine how one would go about finessing some of these details. In our world, it's very, very important to pursue those ideas, sometimes to minuscule detail. Ultimately, I have chefs that will say, where do I put my tongue? Where is this garnish? Where is the plate? Where is, and in a perfect world, I get to do all of those things standing in one place. I don't really want to take more than a step. So you can imagine if you have a large menu, all of a sudden your station gets pretty dense. Mm-hmm. But that's what we try to accomplish.
Right. It's funny, the irony is, you know, a lot of people when you ask them in their home kitchen, oh, what do you want in your home kitchen? All they want is big. I want a big counter, yeah. Big stove, big refrigerator. And it's almost like in the restaurant, it's like, how small can we make everything?
It's really true. So I actually kind of hate most people's kitchens, right? Because, you know, the triangle, you know, the stove, the sink, and the refrigerator, but nobody ever says that the stove, sink, and the refrigerator being a 20-foot triangle is a terrible thing, right? You know, just because you got a triangle doesn't mean that it's particularly efficient. But it goes back to just as chefs and cooks in professional kitchens concentrate on mise en place. You know, you and I, if we were going to do a dinner together, the first thing you and I would do is think about the menu, and we would spend the first many, many hours actually doing all the prep work, right? And we would chop and organize and have containers of all the components, have all the tools lined up, and the outcome, the plates and the platters, that would have to be organized at the other end. And then you start. And that's essentially what professional cooks do day in and day out. Their mise en place is so important because you and I both want to show up at a restaurant at 7 p.m., along with the 1,000 other people who want to do the same thing. You all sit down, and everybody winds up ordering essentially at the same time. The order printer in the kitchen starts spitting out four tops times 20 all at once, and the guys on the line are trying to prioritize looking at the conductor, the chef, who is giving them instructions on what to do first. And if you think about it that way, you can imagine doing a really, really complicated dinner party at home, multiply that by 100, and needing to do that perfectly over and over and over again without fail. Right. That's what my clients do.
Right.
Jimmy, can you tell us about a particular kitchen problem that you had to solve?
Sure. Once upon a time, some years ago, I had been hired to do a kitchen for Chef Gray Kuntz at the Time Warner building. He was pretty late in taking the space. So the space that we wound up with was actually a triangle. And the hypotenuse of the triangle was the glazed curtain wall looking at Columbus Circle, the view that everybody wants. The trouble, of course, is that this was kind of like an isosceles triangle that's skinny and long with a hypotenuse looking at the fountain and the smallest point being the connection to the mall. That was the entrance. And in fact, that was the public entrance as well as the receiving end of the building. So we had the problem of saying, well, you know, if product is coming in and out at the tip of the triangle, as well as trash leaving at the tip of the triangle, and customers are coming in and out at the tip of the triangle, then you have a real spatial problem of orientation. Normally, one would put the kitchen in the back of the space and leave the nicest view to the customer. In this instance, as hard as we could try, because of the shape of the space being a narrow triangle, the only rational way we could solve the problem was to put the kitchen on the curtain wall side. And we struggled with it until Gray Kuntz said, you know, we could have an open kitchen and the customers could be raised so that they're looking through the kitchen at Columbus Circle. And that's how that problem got solved. So there's a way that the puzzle wants to be solved, and you can either go with it or you can fight it. And you can usually tell the spaces that have been fought against because there's something fundamentally wrong, like you're walking by the bathroom at the wrong place, or the kitchen door is next to the entrance, or the coat room is nowhere to be found. I mean, those are all fundamental things that occur when you're fighting a space, and it really didn't want to be what it is. So you wind up with stuff all over the place and places that you really, really can't work with.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, it's been great talking with you, Jimmy. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Jimmy Yui is an award-winning restaurant designer, and Francis Lam is our host. Ray Kroc, the man behind McDonald's, has probably had a bigger impact on modern American dining than almost anyone else, for better and worse. Ironically, and some would say serendipitously, his wife Joan may be more well-known today than he is, thanks largely to her philanthropic gifts to public radio and elsewhere. Lisa Napoli's book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away, tells the fascinating story of this unusual couple. Our contributor, Russ Parsons, spoke to Lisa Napoli in Los Angeles.
Lisa Napoli, welcome to Splendid Table.
Thank you for having me here.
So there are so many fascinating angles to this couple, Ray and Joan Kroc, and the company that they built. What was it that attracted you to them to begin with?
Well, it wasn't because I was a McDonald's fan or eater. It was because of this curious sculpture here in Southern California that was in disrepair that it turns out Joan had anonymously funded years and years ago. So that kind of set me on the trail, besides the fact that you hear her name recited on public radio at least daily. But to understand about her, I had to know about her husband. And to understand about her husband, I had to know about McDonald's. So that consumed the last 5 years of my life.
McDonald's usually gets credit for having created or at least perfected the fast food model that's so prevalent today. What is it that they actually did differently? There were hamburger stands all over the United States. Why McDonald's? What did they bring to the game?
In the case of McDonald's, it was pretty simply clear that what they did that the other hamburger stands didn't do is orchestrate or choreograph this hamburger dance that allowed the movement of food from creation to you and your mouth very quickly. And that's what set them apart from others. Then there were other things like the creation of the golden arches, which made McDonald's stand out on the roads, although other people were doing that too. But it really was this efficient system, the speedy system, they called it. Ray Kroc looked at this system and said, aha, that's it. Because he was a milkshake machine salesman. He was before that a paper cup salesman. So he'd been in hundreds of malt shops, fast food stands, roadside food stands. And he knew when he saw it that this was a really super efficient system. The food was pretty good, too. It was locally sourced and prepared to very specific specifications. But what he found he didn't invent it, nor did he invent franchising. He just identified it. And he had the gumption to go out and shop it around.
In a way, he was a very archetypal American character of that period because apparently, he was an irresistible salesperson.
Yes. He was a difficult guy. You either loved him or you hate him. This hail fellow, well-met type character that some people found very brusque, but he liked to close the deal and he'd been very successful. So he didn't want to take no for an answer. The problem was he didn't have any business sense, but he did know how to close a deal. And that was what fired him up. Yeah.
In many ways, the story of Ray and Joan Kroc, it reads almost like some kind of 50s film noir plot. How did they meet and how did their relationship evolve?
They met because of McDonald's. Ray was shopping around in the Midwest. The idea for McDonald's, selling franchises for $950 a pop. And he walked into a very elegant restaurant in St. Paul, Minnesota, the Criterion, and he wanted to sell a franchise to the owner of that restaurant who wanted to diversify. He was a good businessman. Jim Zine was his name. And he had hired Joan Smith, a young, beautiful local talent, to play organ in this restaurant and to entertain the diners. And what I love about this, Russ, is that we think of going out to eat as something we've always done. I mean, it was very unusual to go out and have an elegant meal. Certain people might have done it more often, but the regular folk didn't go out to these restaurants. So there was a sense of elegance to this restaurant that just really set it apart. And the fact that Ray walked in and saw this beautiful woman playing organ really excited him. And from there, lots
like
happened.
Ray Milland and Veronica Lake, maybe, you know?
Yes, cue the music. And yeah, it's amazing. You can almost see it in the way Ray describes it.
And of course, both of them were married at the time.
Important to point out that they were both married at the time. And interestingly, and not coincidentally, Joan's husband at the time suddenly became the manager of the McDonald's franchise that Ray sold to Joan's boss and later got the right to own franchises himself. So lots of McDonald's in their early personal history, even before they became a couple, because it took them about a dozen years before that happened.
Franchise operations have come and they've gone. I mean, it's still a very popular way to structure a restaurant operation, but few have had the staying power of McDonald's. What do you think was the key to their success?
The key to their success, and Ray even said it, was thanks to a man named Harry Sonnenborn, who'd come over from Tasty Freeze, another early iteration of these fast food stands. And Harry Sonnenborn had this idea. He said, Ray, you are not in the hamburger business. You are in the real estate business. And Harry, being a very wise businessman, went out and negotiated loans in the developing suburban areas of America to buy land that had been unused and convince banks to provide the underwriting mortgages so that they could build these McDonald's from town to town to town. So it was his idea that it be about the real estate. And that's what keeps McDonald's today. It's not the food. It's about the real estate and the business behind the franchising. And other franchisees understood that earlier. They were selling their franchisees food, but Ray didn't want to do that. He wanted to sell the blueprints, and it was Harry who saved the day with this real estate formula.
McDonald's in the 1950s versus McDonald's today. I mean, Kroc's idea was everything was extremely streamlined. Everything was extremely efficient. Today, McDonald's sells breakfast, salads. It does almost anything that you want. It's almost a casual restaurant. What do you think he would think about McDonald's today?
It's hard to know. You know, I try to wonder. I try to put myself in his head, and it's hard to know. I think that he was, at a certain point, it just transitioned to his being Mr. McDonald's, and he was always a clean freak. And I go into McDonald's sometimes to get coffee, which is the only thing I'll have there. And the bathrooms are sometimes horribly dirty. And Ray would be appalled at that. So I think it would be less about the food and more about how these places are run and staffed. He was all about customer service, quality and service and value were his mantras. But I think, you know, when you go back to the early days of McDonald's and you think the McDonald brothers had this brilliant idea to pare down a menu and make it as simple as possible, because the idea was then you could pay attention to the food and the food could be as fresh and local as possible. What you're seeing today is very different than what they wanted, certainly, and even in many ways what Ray would have wanted, too.
Lisa, thank you so much. It's such a fascinating story.
Thanks
for being on Splendid Table with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Napoli is author of Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Russ Parsons is author of the classic, How to Eat a Peach. Now, if you find yourself craving a really good burger, check out our recipe for Less is More Burgers. You'll find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, we're letting Marcus Samuelson into our pantries, and America's Test Kitchen evaluates tea kettles. And let me tell you, that is no simple task. I'm Sally Swift, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Sally Swift, in this week for Francis Lamb. So where does a first-rate chef and philanthropist begin to form? How about at a hot dog stand in Sweden? That was Marcus Samuelson's first job in food. As an Ethiopian child, orphaned at three, Marcus was adopted by a Swedish family. He chose a profession where black men were usually dishwashers, rarely chefs, and then he became the youngest chef to earn 3 stars from the New York Times. Today, he has restaurants in New York, D.C., London, and Sweden, and he works just as hard at raising money for charities. People beg invites to the fundraisers he throws at home, where he cooks his home food. And that's what his book, Marcus Off Duty, is all about. Contributor Rebecca Shear met up with Marcus to talk home-cooked meals and what to have in the pantry.
So let's talk about the very start of the book. You talk about your grandmother's kitchen.
Yes.
And how that's where your journey with cooking began, and how now you feel you've come full circle, which I love. I love that phrase. Tell us about your early memories of home cooking and how exactly it is that you've managed to come full circle from those early days.
Well, first of all, I would have loved to have had at least a week with my grandmother now, right? Wouldn't we all? But she's not here, but she's looking, sitting above and looking down on us, and she would be laughing because everything she cooked is hip now. If she would have known that fish liver and pig feet and pig ear and carrots, kale, Brussels sprouts, you know, she would have been like, what's going on? You went to cooking school to cook what I taught you? You know, so that's a statement right there, right? Sometimes we have to go back in order to move forward.
You talked about your family, and you have a wonderful multinational family.
Yeah, I mean, I thought every family growing up was Swedish, a little bit Korean, a little bit Jewish, and a little bit Ethiopian. But you know what? It's an interesting time to grow up in the 80s in Sweden. So I feel very fortunate that I was raised in a multicultural family, and it came through food.
And extending that multiculturalism of your family, your cookbook is incredible. It's global. It includes everything from coconut lime curried chicken to lamb lasagna. We have Ethiopian tostadas.
Yes.
So it looks to me like you must have an enormous pantry. And I would love for you to give us some idea of what to do with what might seem like some of the more exotic ingredients you include. I'm especially intrigued by that Southeast Asian chili paste you mentioned, sambal oelek.
Sambal oelek is wonderful, you know. It's really a chili, almost like a chili paste, a little bit rougher than a chili paste. Sambals are used all over Southeast Asia, also a lot in South Africa, actually. And it's a great rub, it's a great spice enhancer, very similar to the more popular known sriracha in a taste. It has no sweetener, it's just really delicious. And you can, you know, thin it out with some olive oil, rub it on a chicken. You can add soy and lime juice, and it can be a vinaigrette. So I love flavor, you know, a pantry that very quickly, with a little bit of acid and a little bit of salt, a little bit of oil, you can just go in different places. It's not so much about how authentic it is. It's about how delicious you want to make it. So I always say, expand on your pantry. Buy something you're not familiar with. You know, try it out. Like miso, for example. You know, we all are familiar with miso soup, but, you know, there's blonde miso, there's red miso, there's dark miso. Well, dark miso, I will rub on a steak, on red meat. Blonde miso, I would use for fish and vegetables. Red miso, I would use for poultry or vegetables, roasted vegetables. They're delicious.
What about harissa?
Oh, so you're just using all the difficult words there? Harissa is from Morocco and Tunisia. And it's a wonderful spice blend because just like Northern African cuisine, it's flavorful but not overpowered spicy, right? So harissa is wonderful to mix with some Dijon mustard, and you can have like a mustard on a hot dog or, a merguez. It's also super delicious with just like, again, roasted root vegetables, chicken, fish, and lamb. Lamb is super delicious. I would just steam fish, brush it with some mint and harissa. Super delicious. We got to stop just looking at sort of European American food. We have the whole world, and it's a more better reflection. For me, it's nothing could be more than American than just trying to find the best ingredients and make them ours, right? You got to learn something when you do, and you got to have fun.
So I think a lot of people flipping through your cookbook, they might look at so many ingredients and dishes as ethnic.
Yes.
Word ethnic.
That word is so, I don't even know what that word means, because everyone is ethnic. Everyone has ethnicity, right? What does that mean? Does that mean that black and brown people and Chinese people are ethnic and white people are not? Every group, you come whether you're English and German, that's your ethnicity, right? So it's also become this sort of quasi word for explaining that's strange and we have balsamic vinegar, but we don't do sambal oelek. Come on, like, Mexican food for me, it's part of an American vocabulary today, right? Is that left ethnic or is that still ethnic? I don't even know when you get the ethnic passport. Is that in Canada or is that in Texas? I'm not poor. I don't really care about it. I just think it's like delicious food you can find all over the world. Sauerkraut is just as delicious as kimchi in the right preparation, right?
Right.
But also, we got to be there's some values that we got to share and say, hey, this is actually better. And then there's some values we got to go back to, right? So we're becoming more diverse, but we're also cooking much more throwback and vintage. We're being more local than ever, right? So we're being both more global in terms of where they come from, but we're also being more local. We care about Farmer Ben and his carrots. We didn't care about Farmer Ben before, whoever, you know, who was. So there's many things happening.
Marcus Samuelson, thanks so much for coming.
Tusen tak. Hej då.
Marcus Samuelson is author of Marcus Off Duty. Check out his latest projects, including Live at Red Rooster Harlem, a collection of Harlem's finest musicians. Rebecca Shear is the host and producer of the storytelling podcast Circle Round. Now, Marcus left us with a recipe to use up some of the things in our ethnic pantries. It's for Durban curry buns. Find it at splendidtable.org. So what comprises kitchen equipment? I think most of us think pots and pans, knives, the stove. Almost no one thinks about the sink. And what about this? Tea kettles are arguably one of the most used pieces of equipment. And when was the last time you replaced yours? Well, we are going to the mistress of equipment testing, Lisa McManus of America's Test Kitchen. Lisa, good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
So I have been replacing a bunch of my equipment because I have changed my stove, and I've been fine with most of my changes. But you know what's been really hard for me is a tea kettle. And it occurs to me, there is a lot to consider when you buy a tea kettle. Have you guys evaluated them?
Yes, we did. I've looked at stovetop kettles, and boy, you know, for something so simple, there's so many parts of it that can go wrong. They can be very heavy. They can be very fragile. They can pour badly. They can burn you and spout steam at you while you're trying to pour. And it's amazing how many different models they are, what different materials and sizes and prices. And I think most people buy the one they think is cute and then suffer.
Right. And you keep it forever.
Yes.
I mean, replacing a tea kettle does not feel like an option. So what do we need to think about when we're looking for one?
Well, you want to make sure it has a lot of capacity. You don't want to have to boil two rounds of water to fill one normal size teapot. So we looked at least 1 quart and bigger. But then you have to also look at the weight. If it's really heavy with nothing in it and you add a quart of water, unless you're trying to build up your arm, because you're going to have to lift that boiling water and you're going to have to pour and hold it up. And if it's wobbling around, it's going to be dangerous and uncomfortable and it's going to be messy. So that's really important. Filling it is really important. A lot of them have these little tiny openings and they're black inside. And so you can't see how far the water has come. And you're trying to get the faucet under there and you're trying to fill it and not fill it too much or not fill it too little. And some of them do not help you at all.
I hadn't thought about that, but of course you can't see what you're filling up.
Yeah, no, we had one that had a fixed handle. Some of them, the handle will flop over to one side and let you get right in there. But it had a fixed handle that was in sort of an arch shape. And then it had this very tight little lid underneath. And you'd have to pull and pull and pull and then, boom, knock your knuckles.
Right.
And then you had to get your faucet under there. And it's jet black enamel inside, so you can't see. So you find yourself sticking your finger in there, like, is it too high?
Right. I've done all of those things.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing about them, there's a strange piece of equipment because they're on the stove all the time, so they get really grungy.
Yes.
Hard to clean.
And everyone who comes in your kitchen sees it, so that is kind of important what it looks like. We did some things where we sprayed them with oil and then heated them up. I banged them with a spoon to see if they dented. I dropped them from a couple inches above the counter a bunch of times. I just really tried to abuse them. And some of them looked dented and greasy and hard to clean, and some of them cleaned up and looked pretty good.
And how do you feel about a whistler or not a whistler?
I like the ones that give you an option, because I know some people who will walk away and leave the thing boiling, and it can boil dry, and that's very dangerous. It's bad for the kettle. It probably destroys the kettle. But also, if you get up early and you don't want to wake everybody up, I'd like ones where you can disable the whistle.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
And also ones that have a whistle that you can actually hear from the next room, because some of them whistle very softly to themselves, and it's like, what good is that? I want a good definitive whistle.
Okay, so what tea kettles did you like?
Well, we definitely liked one that kind of met all of our criteria. It had a nice big capacity, but was lightweight, has a brushed stainless steel finish, so it doesn't really show a lot of, you know, fingerprints or anything. It's nice and light and shiny inside, so you can see when you filled it enough, because honestly, if you fill them too much, the water will spurt out the handle. It poured very neatly without a lot of splashing, even when it was full, has a handle that doesn't get hot, a whistle you can disable, a nice big opening for filling, and it's by OXO. It's a Good Grips classic tea kettle.
Once again.
Well, you know, they work on this sort of stuff.
They do work on this kind of stuff.
I mean, sometimes everything they make isn't perfect, but oftentimes when you actually think about the function and the day-to-day use of a product, you would make changes to a lot of products that are out there. And I think they pay a little bit of attention to that, which is helpful.
And did you evaluate any glass kettles?
I did. I looked at one by Modelco, which is a very classic one. Your grandma probably had it. It looks like one of those old school coffee pots. It's glass, kind of round with a little black plastic handle and a spout. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is it is so fussy and delicate. There were lots of warnings about not doing this or that, and you had to boil it only on low. And, you know, one of the things we did learn was that you want to match the size of the kettle to the burner. And this one was really important. They didn't want any heat coming up around the sides. Yeah. And you had to worry about it being set down on cold things because of thermal shock. It was...
Yeah, we don't need that.
Yeah, too much babysitting. This is something that's supposed to be comforting for you, making you a cup of tea, not the other way around.
Right. And so how expensive was your winner, that OXO?
It's $39.95. It was right in the middle of the price range. I mean, some of these were $75. Some were as low as $9.99. This was right down the middle, about $40.
Sounds like a classic and one you won't be replacing.
Hopefully not.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Lisa McManus is the boss of equipment testing and ingredient tasting at America's Test Kitchen. You can find that tea kettle evaluation at splendidtable.org. Olia Hercules writes about the food she grew up with in the Ukraine and Eastern Europe. That food might be a surprise to those of us who equate that part of the world as gray and bleak. That food is, in fact, full of new, old ideas and brimming with fresh flavor and color. Cold cucumber salads and wilted sorrel, bright cheeses and fresh pies filled with sour cherries. Olia talked with our contributor, Washington Post food and dining editor Joe Yonan, about her first book called Mamushka.
Olia, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure completely. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with an obvious question. Describe the flavors of the Ukraine.
One of the most common ones and stereotypical ones are, of course, it's dill. I mean, my photographer, when we shot the book, he said, Olia, we should rename your book into Dill, the cookbook. There is a lot of dill and we use it in everything. But actually, the taste of Ukraine, especially southern of Ukraine, where I come from, is freshness. Loads of herbs, kind of really balanced and complex flavors, like loads of sweet and sour. Amazing produce. There's no shortcuts. You can't use bad ingredients because we don't have many spices to hide behind. So you have got to have amazing vegetables and really, really good quality meat. You don't have to have it every day, but, you know, once a week, if you have like some really amazing free-range organic pork, these are the flavors.
I'm fascinated by the ingredients that you talk about in your book. And so I thought I'd ask you about something that, you know, we all think we know here, which is the gherkin pickle. We think of them as these little vinegared pickles, but I think in your experience, they're something much better than that.
They are. We don't actually use much vinegar in Ukraine for pickling stuff. We ferment stuff, which is a great and trendy thing right now. And, you know, when I saw this trend happening, I was just like, hold on a minute, guys. This is something that I actually grew up with. you know, we just did it because Ukrainian food was so seasonal. We grew so many wonderful things. And then in winter, we wouldn't be able to buy those fresh produce anywhere. So we'd just ferment it. We make a little brine and we infuse it with some dill blossom. So dill tops, you know, if you can't find it, you can just use dill stalks. Then other aromatics like blackcurrant leaves. If you can't find that, it doesn't really matter. The main thing is that you get a weak brine, so some salt and some spring water, and you put your gherkins into it and you leave them out in your kitchen to go a little bit funky for a couple of days. And then once you can see that they start fermenting and the liquid is bubbling a little bit, you put it in the fridge. So the taste is... it's just incredible. It tastes alive. And if you keep them out for about 10 days, we call them yadrone agurchiki, which means they're kind of nuclear. Nuclear in the best kind of way. They're so strong. Like, it's not the vinegar kind of strong. You know, it doesn't make you go rinse your face. It's more, I don't know. It's just so deep in flavor. I really love it.
So this might be the first book in a long time, Olia, that I have seen call for margarine. What is that about?
I know. I actually, you know, when I send my recipes to my publisher, I did say, okay, so my family recipes include margarine in it. If you want me to take it out, I will, and we'll just substitute it with butter. And then my publisher is just so nice that they said, look, we want it to be as authentic as it was to your childhood. So that's why I left it in.
It was the 80s. That's what people use.
It was the 80s, yeah.
So I was so fascinated also to see you talk about sunflower oil.
Oh, yeah. In Ukraine, unrefined sunflower oil is a real kind of thing. And also in Georgia, it's so nutty and it just tastes of toasted sunflower seeds. It's not, I don't know if it's for everyone. Some people have been like, oh, it's almost like sesame seed. It's so strong. But you don't need much of it. You just pour a little bit on your salad and I think it's wonderful.
You're not typically using it for cooking then. It's a finishing
oil. No. You can't use it for cooking. It's just to be used raw. Like, you definitely can't use it for frying because it will just burn.
So, Olya, if you had to pick a favorite recipe in your book, what do you think it would be?
One of them is definitely the green borscht. You know, you make a really wonderful, rich duck stock, and then you serve it with some sorrel leaves and loads of herbs and spring onions and a little bit of chopped soft-boiled egg. It's just such an amazing recipe, I think. And another one is probably the chicken tabaka, the Georgian pressed garlic chicken. And it's got lots of butter and garlic in it to begin with. So it kind of gets confit in all of the garlic and butter. And then at the end, you mix it with this incredible combination of herbs. So you use red basil, if you can't find red basil, normal basil will do, dill, coriander, and a little bit of tarragon. And I know it sounds a little bit weird, but the combination of those herbs just makes it go pow. So you just add it at the very end to the butter and the garlic, and then you serve it with some bread, and imagine dipping your bread into that. It's a good dish.
Olya, the food just sounds lovely. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope it gets people excited about Ukrainian food.
Olya Hercules is author of Mamushka, and her latest book is about the food of the Caucasus. It's called Kaka. Find a recipe Olya shared with us for garlicky Georgian poussin and Georgian plum chutney. Now, poussin are just little young chickens, and I make this recipe all the time. It's simple and finger-licking, with or without the chutney. Find it, splendidtable.org. Coming up, lessons in training your wine palate, and yes, practice makes perfect. I'm Sally Swift, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Sally Swift, in this week for Francis Lamb. Do you know a good wine from a bad one? If not, don't worry, because we are here to tell you that you can train yourself with a few simple tools, and I am pretty confident that you already have them in your kitchen. Pretty soon, you will be throwing around words like tannin and flinty and whetstone and acidity with the very best of them. Wine and drinks writer Megan Krigbaum sat down with our contributor, New York Times columnist Melissa Clark, for a workout.
Megan, so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
As you know, I love drinking wine. You know that well. But I really want to be a better taster. I want to be better at tasting wine. So how can you help me?
So we did this story at Food & Wine last October, and I went to a bunch of experts to sort of figure out what are the main components that you need to know about to taste wine. This is something that sort of takes you into the food world rather than directly into the wine world, which is a little bit easier to understand. I went to Josh Wesson, and he's just a tremendous brain, and he does a lot of speaking and education. So everyone thinks there's a right or wrong when it comes to tasting wine, but really the truth is there are just a handful of components that you can know about to be a better wine taster. So I'm going to show you how to taste for tannin, sweetness, and oak. And the first one that is really big and sort of hard to understand is tannin.
Yeah, because you hear that associated with wine all the time, but then where else do we find tannin? Where else does it exist in the world?
Yeah, tannin, you can find tannin in walnuts, okay. Sort of that little bitter
yep.
thing. But what Josh told me about is the tannin that you find in black tea. So just some really simple packs of Lipton tea can mm-hmm. teach you a lot about tannin. So what I have here is I've made 2 cups of tea for you. One was steeped for 2 minutes.
Okay.
And one is steeped for 4 minutes. And tannin really is a textural component
Should
when
I try
it comes
these?
To wine. Yeah.
Mmm, tea. Okay, I see. So the second one is there's a bitterness, there's almost a raspiness on my tongue.
Yeah, it should feel kind of almost dry in this way, like that your palate is really sort of cleaned off and you get that sort of bitterness in the back of your throat.
The 2-minute cup is perfect as it is. The 4-minute cup, I want a little milk.
Exactly. And you could probably go a little even more extreme on this and do an 8-minute cup as well, and then you would really get that tannin in your face, but it's not very pleasant for sure.
So now that I've tasted those, you've got 2 wines for me to taste?
Sure. So the first wine that I'm going to pour for you is this Beaujolais. And this is from Burgundy. It's from Southern Burgundy. And it's from an amazing producer named Marcel Lapierre. He actually died a couple years ago, but his legacy carries on and he makes this gorgeous wine. And it's made from the Gamay grape. This would be the one that's lower in tannin.
Oh, that's delicious. So what's this next one?
So then this next one is a Bordeaux. It's mostly Merlot. And so this, you should taste that dryness, the similarity to the black teas.
Oh, that's delicious too. But yes, that one dries my tongue out immediately. You know, it's funny. With the wine, I don't mind my tongue being dried out. But with the tea, it's disconcerting. It's interesting, maybe because I expect it. What in wine accounts for the tannins?
It's part of the grape. So you can get tannins either from the skins or from the seeds of the grape. So when they press the grapes, if they press them really hard, you'll get a lot of tannin extracted from the seeds. And if they press them lightly, you won't so much. And then also the skins, the thicker the skin, the more tannin you'll have.
I see. So, Megan, is there an ideal amount of tannin that you're looking for in a wine?
Well, I think it depends on what you're going to drink it with. I mean, ideally, you would drink this Bordeaux with something sort of either rich or meaty, something really substantial. You want the fat to pair up with tannin. With something lighter like Beaujolais, you could almost drink it on its own, but it would also go well with like lighter foods, you know, chicken or vegetables or something like that.
Seafood,
yeah.
Now, what's the next component that you're going to show me?
So the next component is sweetness. And what I have for you here is a glass of essentially lemon juice. We took about a cup of water and we squeezed the juice of half of a lemon into it. And it's very concentrated. So I'd like for you to taste that now.
Wait, that doesn't sound very sweet to me.
Not sweet yet at all.
Ooh, sour.
Super tart, right?
Yes.
So we have this some sugar for you.
Yes,
and
please.
What I'd like you to do is sort of start, put a little sugar in and stir it in and then taste that and see how you're doing with that.
I'm just going to really just add a lot of sugar here because that is quite tart. It's like it's lemonade without the sugar. Okay.
And so that's probably
that
pretty balanced
it.
At that point. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. You still have the tartness of it, which is really nice, but you'll also have the sweetness. So we're kind of in the realm of talking about Rieslings that can be either really sweet or not sweet at all in the dry realm or sort of somewhere in the middle.
So what's the right balance between acidity and sweetness? I mean, what are you really looking for when you try to choose a good white wine?
Well, I think you might want something that's very dry, very tart on a really hot summer day. When you're sitting outside, hanging out with your friends, having a picnic, you might want something super refreshing like that. But then you might want something with a little bit of sugar to it. Maybe if you're having scallops on the grill or something a little richer, it's nice to have a little bit of fruit. Even something spicy, some like Thai food that has some good heat to it.
Right, Riesling and Thai food.
That. Exactly. And then if you went a little further, and so that would be a pretty sweet example, and that you can still do that with some spicy food, but you also could do that with more dessert kind of items.
I was always told with a dessert wine that the dessert should be as sweet as the wine. They should be equal. Is that?
I think really you want the wine to be sweeter than the
dessert. The wine to be sweeter. Okay.
Yeah. I think that's the ideal. The next one I want to show you about is another lesson from Josh Wesson, and I had never heard this before. This is about oak and tasting oak in wine. So we all know that a lot of wines end up in a barrel at some point. Sometimes the barrel has a lot of influence because it's new and freshly toasted, and sometimes it has minimal influence because it's old. So Josh told me that if you take some Cheerios, so here are some Cheerios for you.
Okay.
Take them in your hand and crush them up.
Crush the Cheerios. Okay. Got it.
Now give it a big smell.
It's
oaty in this way, but it's toasty, and it kind of gives you the idea of what maybe an oaked Chardonnay would taste like or a white wine that has oak influence, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it smells a little bit ever so slightly smoky, but not a lot, just a little bit.
Right. It also has that vanilla-y flavor to it.
And the vanilla comes from the oak as well.
Exactly, those notes. And then another funny little experiment that Josh taught me about is with some toasted marshmallows. So we toasted these marshmallows just over a flame on the stove. If you give those a smell, this will kind of give you a sense of what oak does to red wine. So it gives this sweet, smoky toastiness. I was totally blown away by that one. I had never heard that before.
Wow. Toasted marshmallows. This really does smell like some Cabernets I've had in the past. Very, very oaky, and it smells great. Wow. Well, Megan, thank you so much. I feel like next time I taste wines, I'll really know how to identify what I'm smelling in the glass and what I'm tasting.
Thank you.
Megan Krigbaum is a wine and drinks writer and a contributing editor to Punch. Melissa Clark's latest book is Dinner in an Instant. I am someone who firmly believes that everyone needs a secret sauce in their repertoire. And today, I'm here with a new candidate. It's actually pretty old. It's called Toum, and it is a garlic paste that Lebanese cooks have been slathering on their kebabs for centuries. Now imagine a bowl of puffy whipped white clouds, lighter than mayonnaise, with a heady nose of garlic and the tang of lemon, and then imagine that it can keep for 3 weeks. The Washington Post's Bonnie Benwick tracked down an authentic recipe for this seemingly magic sauce. Hey, Bonnie, nice to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Can you tell me about this?
Well, I've actually been buying this garlic paste, known to the Lebanese chef who makes it and other people as Toum, T-O-U-M. I'm probably not saying it quite right. Anyway, he sells it in small and big batches in his deli and makes it by the bucketful every single week for his cafe across the hall.
But paste is not what it is. You brought me a little bit. It is fluffy.
It is not. It is really otherworldly. I mean, it's the magic of a really good food processor or Vitamix or Roboku, depending on who you are. And it turns it into something that looks like egg whites. It's that fluffy. It's that light. And the best thing about it is I've learned that it just sort of mellows out the garlic enough, and you can stir it into so many different things. And what it started out being used for was basically to marinate chicken for shawarma. But he's branched out. I've learned to branch out, and I got kind of a little addicted to the stuff. This garlic paste I can have ready to go in my refrigerator, and I've kept it for a month.
Well, you've brought some into the studio, and it is beautifully fragrant, I have to say. So tell me how you make this.
It's four ingredients. It's a very light canola oil, and the chef, his name is Joseph Kamali, by the way, a longtime embassy chef in D.C. He told me that a lot of people use olive oil, but it tends to make it heavy. And the difference is you might get something that's creamy rather than something really fluffy and light and ethereal like his is. So it's a light canola oil, lots of peeled garlic cloves.
Like how many are we talking here for a batch?
Well, to make about 4 cups, and if you're going to make it, you may as well make it. So for about 4 cups, which lasts me about a month, it takes about 7 heads worth of garlic.
Okay.
And, you know, there are easy ways to peel whole heads of garlic. And 1/4 cup of lemon juice and water. That's it.
And you whir it up in a food processor.
Yeah, the sort of cool thing is he took me through the steps of the process. It's the layering and the way that you put it in the blender or food processor. It makes a big difference.
And tell me how you use it.
Well,
or tell me when you don't use it, it sounds like.
I did start marinating chicken with it. Or even because it's so potent, I will just slather it on some chicken breasts or some chicken that I'm going to make kebabs with later and put them on the grill. It just commands a whole bunch of flavor in a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. But lately, I've been stirring it into eggs in the morning.
Oh, delicious.
My colleagues love me. With a little bit of creme fraiche and some tomatoes. You know, it can taste Greek. It can taste Italian. It can taste Mediterranean, really. It's now my go-to base for garlic toast. You know, usually you melt the butter and you stir in the garlic and then maybe you burn it and maybe they're, you know. Another thing that I like about it is I'm not chewing on little bits of garlic.
Right.
And I'm not worrying that it's getting, you know, too dark in the pan or whatever. I've also put it in cold and hot soups. The thing is, it's very light, but it does immediately disperse. Hmm. You don't get a big oil slick because, really, if you're talking about the garlic suspended in that oil, it's not held in a lot of oil,
right,
the amount that you're using. And I'm talking about using it in teaspoons and a tablespoon at the most.
Right. And so tell me, what is the way to peel heads of garlic? What's your trick?
Well, you can do it a couple of ways. You can put them in a big mixing bowl and put another bowl on top of it so that you're creating kind of a closed ball. You're going to shake it as hard as you can. It makes a lot of noise. And then when you open it up, just about all the peel has fallen away from the individual cloves if you've done it right.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that you can do very easily is soak them. For this recipe, it doesn't matter at all. And that tends to be what I do.
In cold water or hot?
In lukewarm water. And cold water doesn't matter. I usually, just to help things along, I will just sort of disengage that, you know, the root end so that they're free to, you know, float and and let the peels do as
free,
they may in the
exactly.
water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to have a bite here.
Good, good. Now, what Sally's trying is a little bit of the straight up fluffy stuff.
Wow, it is beautiful. It also kind of reminds me of mayonnaise.
Yeah, a little bit. But light, you know.
Oh, my. Delicious and light.
See, now you're done for the day.
Robert, that is a wallop of garlic.
Yep. And that's a very fresh batch.
Delicious.
Wow. And it's just easy and on hand. And I feel like once you've made it, which, again, really takes about 10 minutes total, you know, you've got it.
And how long does it keep?
Well, our recipe online said about 3 weeks, but I've let it go for a month. And the only thing it does, it condenses just a little bit. It's not quite as fluffy, but still quite nice.
And keep it in the refrigerator.
Absolutely in the refrigerator.
What a great tool. Thank you very much, Bonnie Benwick.
Sure thing.
Bonnie Benwick is deputy food editor and recipes editor at the Washington Post. Find that recipe for Tomb on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Great to have you with us. Frances will be back next week with an hour that looks at the complicated world of restaurants. In the meantime, have a great week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And by the way, in case you have missed us reminding you like we are your mother, there are a lot more episodes like these available in our podcast archives. So be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and let us know what you think. We really want to hear from you. No, really, we really do. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Francis Lamb is our host, and he is back in the house next week. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Sally Swift, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.